The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of
auto, home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you
to discover the difference at
necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at
imagine.d-h.org.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. New Englanders tend to break down into two camps, the outdoor enthusiasts who long for winter's white slopes, and those of us who grumble about the dark and cold, turn up the heat, read, and watch Netflix. If you count yourself among the latter, it may be time to take a page from the people of Norway, who, according to new research, don't seem to suffer from the same sorts of seasonal mood swings as we do here in America's Northeast. Laura Vanderkam is an author and contributor to Fast Company, where she recently shared some Norwegian secrets to embracing the winter. Laura, nice to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us a little bit about this. Carrie Leibowitz, now she's a PhD student who did this study. What was she looking at and why?
Well, she had spent a year in northern Norway, and originally she went to study why rates of seasonal blues seemed to be a little lower than you would expect, given that in the north of Norway, the sun doesn't rise from late November to late January. They're so far north. And so she went to study that, and she was asking people, well, why aren't you depressed in the winter? And their answer was, why would we be? And she thought that was very fascinating. And so her research studied on this, the wintertime mindset that makes it possible to enjoy rather than endure winter.
A mindset? What are Norwegians doing that we in New England aren't?
Well, we might be doing some of these things, but there is a word that's, I'm going to pronounce it wrong because my Norwegian is shockingly not that great, but it's like kuselig, and it means coziness. And the way to think of it is Christmas without all the stress, right? It's like the best parts of Christmas, the candles, the coziness, the friends, the warm drinks and get-togethers and things like that. And they view winter as a great time for that. So there's lots of fires and fireplaces, even in sort of public buildings. They also have a saying that there's no bad weather, only bad clothing. And so if you are miserable, maybe that's a sign that you need something a little bit warmer, something a little bit more wind or waterproof, and that if you are able to deal with the harsh parts of the elements, then you can get outside and enjoy the beautiful parts of it, because there are beautiful parts of winter if we're willing to open our eyes and look.
Well, that sounds wonderful and cozy, but I'm wondering if there's any, I don't know, besides getting together with people, you said it was about an attitude. Is there any direct advice on how not to handle the coming winter?
Well, you can choose whether or not to be in a negative frame of mind about winter. The way I put it is refuse to participate in the misery Olympics. I think a lot of us have a tendency to start our wintertime conversations by complaining about the weather. Oh, it was a horrible commute. Oh, it was so cold. Like, oh, this weather is so terrible. Can't wait for spring. And when we start our conversations that way, that sets the tone. But when you dwell on unhappiness, you get more of it. So better off to start with something good about the winter, because there's always good, no matter where you look, whether it's that the snow is beautiful this morning, or, you know, we had great hot chocolate last night, or whatever it is. Dwelling on something that is good puts you in a good frame of mind for enjoying rather than enduring winter.
I admire that, but I'm just wondering if, you know, people who do suffer from sad seasonal affective disorder are just going to feel even worse about themselves, thinking that, oh, well, if I just improve my attitude.
Well, I think there's a dividing line here, because there are people who truly do clinically suffer from seasonal affective disorder, and that's a different matter. For those people, you need to get what help you need to get. And whether that's light boxes, treatment, mental health professionals. That's great. I think most of us do not fall into that camp. We are perhaps unhappy in winter, but not in a sort of clinical sense of depressed about it. And for people who fall in that more sort of middle of the road category, you can consciously choose to make the most of it and to get outside, even if the weather is not great, and to enjoy that fresh air and to get together with friends and to enjoy breaking out the sweaters and the scarves and the boots and things like that.
Are you going to do that this winter?
I am going to try my best because I am not much of a winter person myself, but I'm planning on asking for some better cold weather running gear for Christmas so I can break away from the treadmill and enjoy running outside.
Well, Laura, thank you so much and have a wonderful winter.
You too.
Laura Vanderkamp, she's author of several books, including I Know How She Does It, How Successful Women Make the Most of Their Time. You can find a link to read her article on the Norwegian winter mindset, which she wrote for Fast Company. It's at wordofmouthradio.org. The Norwegians may have their secrets to enjoying winter's harshest conditions, but here in New England, nary a snowflake has fallen. In fact, parts of New Hampshire are expected to reach a high of 60 degrees on the 25th. Hardly a white Christmas. So how are Granite Staters feeling about the unseasonable weather? Well, word of mouth producer Megan Tan hit the streets of downtown Concord to find out.
Excuse me. Could I ask you how you guys feel about the weather?
It's weird. It's very strange. It's gloomy. Nothing's white.
I don't even have a scarf on today. And I don't really need my gloves.
I'm more inclined to go out and mow my lawn than to go holiday shopping.
Yeah, this is really sad.
I think right now I really want the snow.
We want snow.
We want to play in the snow.
I don't want it to be 70 degrees on Christmas.
It's not Christmas.
It makes it hard for me to get in the holiday spirit because one of the things you depend on for the holidays is that the snow and the weather outside, frightful, all that stuff. And it just doesn't materialize. It's disappointing.
We want to see white Christmas. You know, that we worried about that only.
And where are you guys from?
We are from Africa.
Because in New Hampshire, there should be snow, and it should be cold and crisp and beautiful. And this is like living somewhere else.
It's like Florida. So far, so good, yeah.
Oh, loving it. Loving it. It's a little bit chilly last couple of days, but I can deal with it. You know, yesterday was a little too chilly, but I'm loving it.
Yeah, it's nice. I could stand to see it snow, but I'm a North Country person.
And you're not sad that it's not going to be, like, snowing on Christmas?
Not at all. I have had way too much of the snow in the past 30 years.
Well, I actually really like the weather. I hate the snow, so this is really nice.
I think if you don't want snow and cold, you should probably not be here.
We play in the snow. We snowshoe, we snowmobile, we ice fish, some of us ski.
I don't ski, I don't skate, but I like to just go out, walk in the snow, play in the snow, take the dog out in the snow, just have fun in the snow.
You know, so we adapt. That's what we're made to do. We're New Englanders.
Yeah.
Okay, can I have your name?
Yes, my name is Kevin.
Kevin. What's your last name, Kevin?
Clark.
Kevin.
Kevin. Oh, another Kevin.
Kincaid.
Mary Bass. Fairhurst.
Fairhurst. Elaine Anderson.
I'm Harry. This is Shannon. Waterhouse.
It's Eric Wheeler.
My name is Madhani Mehratap.
Belletta Saga.
John Simonello.
Ashley Bishop.
What's your name, Megan?
I'm Megan. Yeah. Thank you so much.
You
guys
Merry
have a
Christmas.
Good. Yeah, Merry Christmas to you too.
And that was from producer Megan Tan on the snowless streets of Concord. It is unseasonably warm, but as they say in New England, if you don't like the weather, wait a minute. Cold winds and snowdrifts are likely around the corner. Conditions Alexander De Steiger expects and welcomes. De Steiger's been the lone winter caretaker of Star Island for the past 19 years. Last year, Sean Hurley visited her on the cold, rugged rock 6 miles off the coast of Portsmouth and brought us this story.
On our first attempt to leave the harbor for Star Island, the muffler was frozen, and the Miss Julie, a 29-foot lobster boat, wouldn't start. On our second try, the impeller broke and the engine overheated. Sailors are superstitious, and if anything goes wrong this time, Brad Anderson jokes, he might have to toss me overboard.
You might be bad luck.
Is it me?
It might be you.
Anderson makes surfboards in York, Maine. He's also the land-based half of Star Island's winter caretaking team. Every few weeks, he makes this 9-mile journey to visit his partner, Alexandra DeSteiger.
Bring supplies, water, food. You know, but fundamentally, she's out there by herself most of the time.
Anderson and DeSteiger first met as tall ship crewmates. And Anderson recalls even then, she was taking pictures of the sea.
She's been a photographer for 28 years probably, but she didn't really do much on the business side of art to actually get seen more and get people to know her work.
DeSteiger's reticence and preference for solitude meant that her art went largely unseen for years. But after self-publishing Small Island, Big Picture, a collection of her photographs in 2013, the world got its first real glimpse of her work.
You know, at some point someone's going to notice and realize how remarkable what she's doing is.
The book led to shows in Portsmouth, Representation, and in Boston this summer, a show at the Pucker Gallery.
Kind of been a big year for her.
Around us, the sharp water crackles with light, and the snow-white islands seem to rise from the waves. DeSteiger meets me on the ice-clad dock in a green army jacket and blue jeans, and leads me over the snow to her caretaker's house.
It's got everything for me. It's got surrounded by the sea. It's rocky and rugged. I feel like I'm a northern girl. You know, I need to feel like I'm suffering somewhat. I just feel more alive that way.
She outlines the significant chapters of her life. First, as a girl wandering through the swamp beside her house.
I remember some days I would, like, the project for the day would be to pack a lunch and head out and try to get lost. That would be my, you know, big hope.
As she grew older, she wanted to get lost in something vaster.
I just had this big romance with the sea, and I always wanted to sail on a ship.
When she turned 18, she signed up for a course of study on a tall ship. She met Brad Anderson, and for the next 9 years, they were sailors.
Do you think you would have come to photography if you hadn't, you know, gone to sea?
I don't know if I would have found my grand passion, the thing that I needed to express, if I didn't go to sea.
DeSteiger took the winter caretaking job 18 years ago. While daily chores occupy some of her time, clearing snow and checking the 20 or so buildings, she spends most of the day doing what she likes.
I call it mooning. You know, I just moon about. Someone once asked me, well, you know, aren't you out there taking pictures all the time? I said, no, you know, I really need to just, you know, moon around. I need to sit for long periods of time and, you know, let my mind clear and just absorb the scene.
But when she finally does see something, the camera comes out.
I think for me, it's the scene itself that is important to me. And then with the photograph that I make of it, I only hope that I can do that justice.
So you're seeing it first with your eye.
Yeah. In my heart. If you have the great arch of the sky, you know, over a thing, you can see how small that thing is. And that's sort of one of my themes is I like that feeling of, you know, being tiny and feeling, you know, minuscule.
The more solitude, the greater the sky seems and the smaller she gets.
If I could have solitude and be with Brad at the same time, that's how I would improve it. But you can't, I could have one or the other.
With her naked eye, from her kitchen, DeSteiger can see the mountain in Farmington, where she lives the rest of the year in a solar-powered cabin.
I'm a person I don't like as well on the mainland. But out here, it's almost like out here is when, you know, I'm a glass of water and I'm just filled right up. And then on the mainland, I spill it all out.
We go for a walk around the island, and I ask her if she's ever met anyone who needed as much solitude as she does.
My dad. He built a house on a mountain in Costa Rica. And his parents, actually, I just learned this. His parents moved to the desert, and they built this little house and out in the middle of nowhere. And that's where my dad grew up. And so I guess it runs in the family.
We hear the sound of Miss Julie's engine rumble to life. And we head for the boat and say our goodbyes and begin to watch each other disappear.
You wouldn't think that you could become more connected to the world you live in by being isolated on an island. But in fact, that's what happens.
DeSteiger, a little dash now against the snow, gets smaller and smaller, alone once again on her island. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sean Hurley.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. And today is the winter solstice, the shortest day and longest night of the year, when the sun will only rise above the horizon for about 8 hours. Still, most of us will continue bustling around in the darkness, thanks to our somewhat surprising ability to get by on relatively little sleep. David Sampson is a researcher at Duke University, where he co-authored a study on the evolution of human sleep patterns. He says humans evolved to get better quality sleep than our fellow primates. And David, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So David, you've spent thousands of hours observing sleep patterns of chimps and orangutans, baboons, other primates. Mm-hmm. What can you tell us about how their sleep patterns differ from ours?
Well, when you compare humans directly to the rest of the primate order, one thing is really striking, and that's how little time we actually sleep relative to every other primate on the planet. The sleep times for chimpanzees and orangutans is somewhere between 9.5 and 10 hours. Prosimii, some of them of which sleep 17 hours out of the day.
So which would be prosimii?
Oh, think lemurs. So distantly related primates.
So Homo sapiens get a lot less sleep than that. Why? How can we get by?
Yeah, so that's sort of the question, right? It's surprising to think that we as humans, we know that there's some sort of relationship between sleep and cognition, because when we have a really bad night's rest or we only get 2 or 3 hours out of the night, we know how it feels to be cognitively impaired the next day. So the fact that we sleep the least is actually quite surprising. You'd think at the very least we would sleep as much as other primates, or maybe even more, because we can manipulate our environment in such a drastic way. So something had to occur in human evolution for this transition to take place. So humans have the shortest total amount of time spent asleep when you look at the averages to other primates, but we have the highest proportion of REM out of any primate. So the distinction here is that REM sleep and deep slow wave sleep, the arousal threshold, that is how readily you can wake up in your environment, is very high. Mm-hmm. So if you're in the very first stages of non-REM sleep, that's stages 1 and 2, if someone says your name, you can wake up pretty easily. If you're in slow wave sleep, which is a completely different brainwave pattern, as is REM sleep, you are essentially, you're dead to the world. So what humans did is throughout evolutionary time, we transitioned to a deeper sleep, but the trade-off was we had to have environments that could facilitate this in terms of high-quality sleep environments that were safe and secure.
So let me stop you there and ask. Yeah. It would make sense, you know, if you're a chimpanzee or orangutan sleeping in a tree, you'd have to have very light sleep because environmental dangers are all around. Is that why those species wake so easily compared to humans?
Yeah, that's the idea. In fact, chimps and other apes, they have it a little better than other primates. Most other primates sleep on branches for substrates. Humans, though, had a transition to a full-time terrestrial ground environment somewhere around the advent of our genus, so around Homo erectus. You can see that our functional morphology is completely different. It's adapted for the ground and not the trees like our Australopithecine predecessors were. So if they were spending all their time on the ground, they were also probably sleeping on the ground. With larger group size associated with Homo erectus, you would have more eyes, you would have a safer environment. If you have the controlled use of fire, you could repel insects with smoke, you could thermoregulate, you could protect from other larger predators. And ultimately, you have a much more stable environment to sleep in, which stability is obviously a critical component of getting deep.
So what kind of advantages would you say better quality sleep afforded early humans?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, first of all, it's a two-pronged approach here, because first of all, you have less total time that you're spending asleep. So that's more total time to do other critical things, such as learn new skills or forge alliances. All these things would have been highly adaptive to these early humans. And not only that, with the higher quality, deeper sleep, you can consolidate those skills that you have more time during the day to learn.
There's a contemporary complaint is that we don't get enough sleep, you know, due to overwork, electronic devices, light pollution, a lot of reasons.
Yeah.
Any insight into whether we are maybe pushing our need for sleep beyond its limit?
Well, it's actually really interesting. A publication just came out in Current Biology that sampled some foragers, some pre-industrial societies across the globe, actually, three different pre-industrial societies, and found that their total sleep time averaged between 5.7 and 7.1 hours, which is kind of surprising. A lot of researchers thought it would be more. So what this tells us is that even the foragers who are living in similar, using subsistence strategies that are similar to how we lived for almost 97% of our genus existence, these people are sleeping not a lot of time out of the day. So this might have been a longer in terms of how much time we dedicate to sleep in a 24-hour period.
David Sampson, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
David Sampson, a postdoctoral associate in the Department of Evolutionary Anthropology at Duke. You can read more about his study on human and primate sleep patterns, all that at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It's late December, a time of celebration and togetherness when we revel in nostalgia, which, as is often acknowledged, can make this time of year very difficult for those of us who don't like Star Wars. Well, with all the box office records, product tie-ins, and unavoidable enthusiasm for the franchise, Star Wars haters are up against the ropes this week. And one of them is Brett Burke. He's author of The Gay Uncle's Guide to Parenting. Brett recently wrote an essay for The Drive called Why I Hate Star Wars, which is now the focus of a barrage of hateful comments for even printing Brett's post. Brett, glad to have you back, but how bad is it for you right now?
Well, you know, I write a lot of things that end up on the internet, and one of the core lessons of writing for the internet is don't read the comments.
Yeah, but now you're messing with Star Wars. Isn't this a whole nother realm?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't gotten any hate mail or death threats or anything like that at my actual home, so I'm feeling pretty secure. Although, you know, there was a guy in a Chewbacca suit standing on my porch when I got home the other day.
Well, is it really Star Wars that you can't stand, or is it the cultural obsession with the movies that bothers you?
Strangely enough, it's both. I mean, I find I found the movies themselves to be kind of tedious, and I feel like there's also this cultural angle that I find troubling. That's this sort of infantilization that goes on around the movies, where you know, generationally these were touchstone movies for people my age. I'm in my 40s. Saw the first movie in the theater, and I understand the idea that they take us back, but I think that the literality of the way in which they take us back, with grown people, you know, wearing Star Wars onesies and eating Star Wars cupcakes, you know, there's something troubling about that to me.
Do you think Star Wars was the real turning point for that, this infantilization or, you know, acting like children?
Well, I think, you know, it came about during a time when America was sort of in decline, right? The malaise years of the mid-1970s, you know, stagflation and the demoralization of our military in Vietnam and all of those kinds of things, the aftermath of that. And I think, you know, people were looking for a way to be told that everything's going to be okay. And these kinds of simple-minded stories with dichotomous good guy, bad guy relationships somehow make people feel better about that situation.
So is there nothing redeeming about that, about the franchise in your eyes?
Well, I don't want to say nothing redeeming. I mean, you know, some of the costumes were kind of funny.
How about the whole thing about, you know, the hero's journey, the ancient myth of the fatherless searching for, you know, the Joseph Campbell approach?
Sure. I mean, yes. You know, if you want to get behind sort of a fatuous foundational family drama, yes. It's right there for you.
How do you really feel, Brett? So I take it you're not going to be going to see the new movie.
I have not seen the new movie. You know, who's to say, right? We all participate oftentimes in things we hate. You know, I have to go to Christmas with my partner's family, you know, every other year. These, you know, there's things like this that we attend just because they're a part of what you're supposed to do. But this, you know, this one is certainly a choice. But you can never tell. Anyone can get swept up.
Right. So you're hearing a little bit of never say never then.
Well, I don't like to be quite as quite as dichotomous in my approach as the Star Wars film.
There's some gray area for Brett Burke. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
And good luck with all the hate mail you're going to be getting after this interview.
I look forward to it.
Brett Burke, he's a contributor to Vanity Fair and author of The Gay Uncle's Guide to Parenting. You'll find a link to read his article, Why I Hate Star Wars, at wordofmouthradio.org. And just a reminder, the views expressed in this program are not those of New Hampshire Public Radio, its staff, or its underwriters. Whether an action-adventure film or a romantic comedy, music plays a big role in shaping the sound and feel of a film. For Star Wars, that means huge orchestras and sweeping arrangements. For horror films, it means something else entirely. Roman Mars is host of the podcast 99% Invisible. He looked into the design of horror movie soundtracks and brings us the story.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars. People who make horror movies know that if you want to scare someone, use scary music. And when we want to explore the design of music, we call Hrishikesh Hirway from the podcast Song Exploder.
So here are two fundamental ways to make something sound scary, according to evolutionary biologist Dan Blumstein. The first way is to use lots of screechy, irregular tones.
Well, the animals, when they're scared, are blowing a lot of air across their vocal cords, and the sounds of screams are something that is arousing and makes people feel negative.
It's biological. Your lizard brain hears Bernard Herrmann's knife-stabbing music in Psycho and says, something terrible is happening right now.
The second way sounds can make you feel uneasy is to go the other way. Make really low, grumbling sounds with lots of bass.
The lowest frequency a species can produce is a function of its body size. So low frequency probably should scare you. It might mean that something big is around.
Mix those both together and you're on your way to creating classic scary music for scary movies. But horror movies aren't just meant to be horrifying. They're also meant to be exciting and fun, so it's sometimes nice to have a driving beat. The music from the movie Halloween by composer John Carpenter will always creep me out and also get me kind of excited.
In terms of horror movies, I certainly know that I respond to sound in horror movies in ways that are complex. You know, John Carpenter's soundtracks are, you know, a good example. You know, that's a very specific thing. It evokes dread.
David Slade is very good at evoking dread himself.
My name's David Slade. I directed the pilot for the first episode of Hannibal, and I'm an executive producer on the show, and I pretty much sound mix every episode.
I've been binging on the TV show Hannibal for the past couple weeks, and it really gets under your skin. It's the story of a serial killer named Hannibal Lecter, who you may know from Silence of the Lambs and Manhunter. The other main character is Will Graham, an FBI profiler who has a knack for getting inside the heads of serial killers to try to catch them. And inside Will Graham's head is exactly where the sound design of Hannibal is trying to place the viewer.
Will Graham visualizes things and he recognizes patterns. This is what he does. He reconstructs things in his head. It's a mental activity. Synapses firing. These are things that we want to make an audio analog of. So there's a lot of clicking sounds.
This is from the first episode of Hannibal. Composer Brian Reitzel wrote the score for Hannibal.
Our whole goal with horror really is to transport people into this other reality. But to do that, I find the most effective way to scare people is to throw sounds at them that are unfamiliar to them.
So Brian constructs new sounds that the audience can't place to create unease.
Almost all the sounds in Hannibal start out as an acoustic element from Brian Reitzel's workshop. Then the effort is made to strip it of identifying characteristics that would ground the sound in the real world.
I'm constantly trying to de-guitar a guitar or de-drum a drum.
That's Brian placing a wooden chopstick on a snare drum and pulling a violin bow across the chopstick. You could never tell by listening that a chopstick, bow, or a drum made this sound.
Brian doesn't just take regular instruments and make them weird. He also takes weird instruments and makes them weirder. I went around Brian's studio as he pulled out examples of the instruments he uses. For example, the sound of synapses firing inside Will Graham's head started out as a Newton's cradle.
But what I did is I used it as a, I used it to create these rhythms, kind of synapse in your brain stuff.
Even the most innocuous instruments turn sinister in the hands of Brian Reitzel.
Mission accomplished, guys. Because I'm creeped the f*** out.
That story came to us from Roman Mars of the podcast 99% Invisible. He was collaborating there with another one of our favorites, Hrishikesh Hirway, of the podcast Song Exploder. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before we get into our next segment, a warning. No, we're not going to be talking about anything sordid or using harsh language, but we will be discussing Santa. So if you're with your kids right now, here is your warning. We're going to be talking about Santa. Okay, we'll give you just a moment. Christmas brings with it festive lights and decorated trees and parties, and for some parents, a conundrum: whether or not to protect the identity of Santa Claus. Joining me now to talk about how parents navigate this Santa story is KJ Dell'Antonia. She's editor and lead writer of the Motherlode blog for the New York Times. KJ, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so we raise children telling them that lying is wrong. So what about the Santa story? Where does that fit in?
Well, you know, that really just fits into our culture. That is joining in a collective and joyful set of varying mythologies about the season that I personally happen to love.
Ah, okay. Well, it has been going on for a long time, but it seems like it's coming up increasingly as an issue for today's parents. Would you observe that?
I do, yeah. We get a lot of letters from parents wanting to know, you know, how other people have handled it. Their children are young. I think there is that moment when your kids are really very, very little, and you're either going down this road or you're not. And so people have some struggle with that. And then, of course, there's the moment at the other end of the road that some people have in which their children are, rudely yanked from the mythology or just come out of it themselves or really in some way just sort of never. I've known some children who've never come to it at all. It just didn't work for them.
How about parents who often construct elaborate staging, you know, with Santa footprints and cookie crumbs and the elf on the shelf? First of all, what is the elf on the shelf?
My favorite Santa staging, I have to tell you, first of all, though, is the reindeer poop. But we'll skip that.
One get it?
I suspect you could Google a recipe, but okay, the elf on the shelf. What the elf on the shelf does is it apparently moves around the house, conducting pranks, and also keeping an eye on the children if you decide to go that route, and reporting back to Santa on whether or not they've been naughty or nice. And let me tell you, that is another piece of this that parents go different ways about. Some parents, you know, full-on embrace, I'm calling Santa. Mm-hmm. I heard a friend yelling that at her 4-year-old just the other day. So that's one that parents struggle with as well. It's not just the whole overarching thing. It's in some ways, it's the details. They really vary from family to family.
Hmm. If you're just tuning in, we're discussing Santa, specifically how parents choose to talk with their kids about Santa. KJ Dell'Antonia is with us. She's editor and lead writer of the Motherlode blog for the New York Times. Is there a way to tell the Santa story without the mythology? I'll use your word.
I don't think so. I really don't. I think that you can, and I have known parents who have just started in with, you know, this is something that other families do and not us. And of course, if you're a Jewish family or if you're, you don't celebrate Christmas for any other reason, maybe you don't want this. And from that, and for those families from day one, it's, you know, this is something that other families do. But I think if you're going to do it, I don't know. I think it's all in. I suppose it could be. I guess I don't really see any reason. I don't see any reason to go down that road if you're not all in.
Well, it's funny because I've talked to a couple of people who say, you know, I want, you know, radical honesty in my family. But then the kid goes walking around in preschool and says,
yes,
you know, and then some problems come back. You have to navigate it with the extended family. You have to deal with other parents or school. So how do you make that choice?
You know, if you are that parent, it does take some conversations with your child, unless you want your child to be that child at preschool. And I'll tell you, that's not really a popular child to be this time of year. I've definitely sat down with friends in the past, because now I'm not worried about it. It is what it is for us. And said, you know, can I just remind you to remind Dory that, you know, we're still happily doing this? Mm-hmm. And they'll be like, oh, yeah, no problem. We'll talk mm-hmm. to them before we come over.
I don't know. You just said, KJ, you just said it is what it is. Are we overthinking this? I mean, people who refuse to toe the line, applying a kind of, you know, adult rigor or demand for the truth, that's not really necessary in this case.
I'm inclined to think so, but it really is a very, very personal it's a funny thing to say, oh, this is a personal choice, Virginia. But it is. And maybe it comes down to the heart of how you are, you know, raising your family in some ways. And, you know, I wouldn't want to say that there's stuff that goes unspoken and that's the way it ought to be, because most stuff should not fall into that category. But let's look at it really nicely and say that in some families, there's just this deeper understanding that we're all enjoying this. So let's do it together.
KJ Delantonio is editor and lead writer of the Motherlode blog for the New York Times. She lives in New Hampshire. We're so happy to have her.
Thank you.
Is that you, Santa Claus?
Okay, so KJ is clearly on the let's all embrace the magic of Santa side of the fence. And now we peer over that fence for another perspective. But before we get to that, a warning to parents that we are talking about Santa, specifically how parents choose to talk to their kids about Santa's identity. Well, so you've been warned. Okay, back to that kid who went around telling the entire preschool that there is no Santa. Well, that child's father is not ashamed, but we have chosen to protect his identity by altering his voice. After all, who knows what damage and parental ire might be the result of a Santa expose? We spoke to him in secret earlier this week. So you are the mysterious person that I identified when I spoke with KJ, whose child stirred things up a little bit in preschool because he told kids that Santa was not real. Or what did he say?
They were talking about what they wanted for Christmas and what they were going to do at Christmas and what they were looking forward to about Christmas. And my child told the others, Santa's not coming to your house. Santa isn't real. Of course, the other kids pushed back and said, well, of course Santa's real. Santa comes to my house every Christmas and brings me presents. And my kid said, no, Santa doesn't do that. Santa's not real. The longer the conversation went on, the more strident the kid got about it. And when I heard about what had happened, I was mortified because I have never said one way or the other anything about Santa. I have neither confirmed nor denied the existence of Santa to this child.
So where did it come from? You had no idea?
I had no idea. I mean, I have a rule that I don't lie to the kid about anything. I will give an age-appropriate answer to any question asked. And that includes what goes on at Christmas time. That said, I have never said that Santa isn't real, and I have certainly never said that you should tell other kids that Santa isn't real.
Mm-hmm. But if you have this policy of sort of, I don't know, radical honesty, one could call it, not ever telling or propagating a myth to your child, there are consequences that come with it, right? I mean, is this the first time anything like this has happened?
It was the first time I had ever thought about it. It was the piece I had never thought to consider. And that's what's really interesting. Whatever it is that you instill in a kid may or may not stick because of the messages they're getting from everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
The same, I think a lot of parents have had the same consequence with gender.
Right.
You know, there are parents who have daughters and they say, well, my kid is going to be interested in science and technology and she's going to be an engineer. And then, you know, lo and behold, they have a 2-year-old girl who says, I want to play with princesses.
So what was the conversation that you had with your child after this?
Well, we sat down and I said, I hear you were talking with the other kids about Santa today. And I know that we don't talk about Santa the way the other kids do, but we talk a lot about politeness. That's the other big value that we have along with honesty. We don't lie, but we also always try to be considerate of other people. And I said, if other kids want to believe in Santa and other kids want to have that as a fun thing, we don't want to be the ones to take that away from them. And the response I got was, no, they can't do that. And I said, well, that just isn't very polite, is it, to talk that way to other kids? What if we just say that for us, we'll talk about Santa in our own way, and they can talk about Santa in their way?
So what if your child were to say to you, I really love Santa and want to believe in Santa, what would you do with that?
Well, that's the funny part, because a couple of weeks after this happened, we were talking, we were decorating our tree and listening to Christmas music, and out of the blue, and this had not come up again since this incident, out of the blue, I hear, and you know who's coming on Christmas, right? Santa! Yay!
So the teachable moment may not have been exactly the moment that you anticipated, that this would be about telling the truth to your child, and instead would be about child finding child's own way.
I think that's what it has come down to, because as much as important as it is for me to be honest, and this is going to sound like a cop-out, my job is not to be the last honest parent, to be the one who spoils and pours cold water on all of the fun of childhood. Because for a lot of kids, Santa really is fun. And I certainly don't want to take that away from anybody. My only goal is that, as a parent, that I am somebody that my kid can come to and answer, that can ask any question about any topic, and that I will do my best to answer it, and that will always be available in our household, in our family.
Well, thank you, mystery guest.
It has been a pleasure sharing my mysterious family dynamic with you.
And mystery guest's voice was disguised not out of shame, but for protection of the family.
I'm a Christmas unicorn in a uniform made of gold, with a billy goat beard and a sorcerer's shield and a mistletoe on my own.
And we'd love to hear from you. How do you talk to your kids about jolly old Saint Nick? Have you gone all in, tracking his movements online? Did your parents go all in? Or are you letting your kids ponder Santa in their own way? You can join the ongoing discussion on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. And thank you so much for spending some time with us today. We invite you to share what you heard with others. You can go to wordofmouthradio.org for a deep list of segments to listen to. You can post on social media or email to friends. And let us know what you are curious about, the stories and sources you find interesting, or what is scratching at that sense of wonder. We find the best stories tend to bounce around by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Let's keep on sharing them. And this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
I don't exist.